In the 6th century in France, there was a monk named Vincent of Varennes who wrote about what Christians believe, that it was believed semper ubique et ab omnibus. That is, Christians believe always the same thing, everybody believed the same thing, and every place they believed the same thing. Which, of course, is nonsense. But if you're a 6th century monk and had traveled 2 miles in any direction from your monastery, and the only people you knew were 6th century monks, and that had a certain plausibility. But that notion of permanence and continuity of the faith, that sort of hyper-permanence, especially when you apply it to God, who is, of course, supposed to be unchanging, has a certain superficial plausibility. However, it has really been pernicious in its effect. I bring this up today because this reading today is a great example of precisely those pernicious effects. This thing is changing color, is that all right? Sorry. Oh, it turned back again. Okay. If you remember, the last line of last Sunday's gospel went this way. Now, Jesus did many other things in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing, you may have life in his name. What does that sound like? Sounds like the end of the writing. At the end of the 20th chapter of the Gospel of John. However, today's whole reading is the 21st chapter of John, which was not part of the original text. Why? Because none of the oldest manuscripts have it. The theology is different, the vocabulary is different, its view of religiosity is different. And it's that difference that I want to talk about today because it is, I think, crucial. And this is not just a lesson in history, but this has, I think, enormous religious implications. But you can't understand those implications if you don't understand the history. The Jordan community was a very strange group. Their gospel was very strange. They called it mystical or spiritual or whatever. Their view of Jesus was very unusual. So as I said last week, it almost didn't make it into the gospel because it was so radically different from the Jesus of the other gospels. And one of the peculiarities of this Johannine community was this. They believed that once you were born again, and that's where that phrase begins, Jesus' interview with Nicodemus, unless you're born again, you cannot blah, 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 blah. They figured that once you were born again, everything was changed, and you could not sin. Because once you had this new life, you're living out of that, and that was a permanent state, and that's all there was to it. And the second consequence of that, if everybody was born again, then nobody had anything to say to anybody else, because everybody knew everything already. In other words, it was a radically horizontally organized community. There were no bosses. And nobody could question anybody else, because they assumed that everybody believed the same stuff. However, the plot thickens. And if you know the first letter of John, which was written probably around 120 in the wake of the gospel and for the same community, you have indications of a massive collapse of that community. First of all, a bunch of the people in the community had believed that Jesus really wasn't human. And as we've seen, that makes all kinds of sense as a consequence from the picture of Jesus that the Gospels depict. So they had that. And then they had this terrible problem of everybody being impeccable. And then that didn't stand up to scrutiny either. And so the community exploded. And the best Johannine scholarship said most of the people believed those two things, that Jesus was not human and you couldn't sin. And if you read the first letter of John, where you have all this wonderful talk about God being love and blah, 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 blah. You have the most angry, vituperative condemnation of those people who left the community. At least this is the way the writer saw it. But what happened, of course, they said, we have to get organized differently. And so here's Peter standing in the wings. I mean, Peter had been dead 70 years, of course. But the Petrine ministry had appeared in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so now we drag in Peter as a kind of arbiter, a figure of Peter in the church. So that's where you get feed my lamb, feed my sheep, tend my sheep. Because these guys, a small remnant of this Johannine community, said we can't go on like this. It's collapsed. It's over. And then we have to have some sort of center whereby differences can be worked out. Because there are differences. That's the point, huh? There are differences. Please note, it says, feed my lamb, tend my sheep. It doesn't say, boss them around, lay down the law, you're in charge, one man, one vote. Which, of course, is the way the church developed, because after Constantine made the Christians legitimate, the church took on exactly the political structure of the Roman Empire, which was profoundly hierarchical. The title that the Pope has to this day, Pontifex Maximus, the big bridge builder, that's the title that was given to the Roman emperors. What I'm getting at, I hope, is beginning to become clear. Pattern of authority that we have in the church to this day, which has been in place literally for centuries, is not carved in stone. Although that's exactly what I was taught in 8.5 years in 3 different seminaries. So where does this leave us? First of all, it opens up the history of the church to say it's been much more complicated, much more differentiated than we think this nice, tidy pattern holding throughout the century. It has never been that. The hierarchical structure of the church, well, let's look at that for a minute. Everybody, a lot of Catholics are very quick to say, well, the church is not a democracy. Well, what is it? A monarchy, then? Which is, of course, what we have today. It's not a monarchy, folks. In fact, if you look at the Pauline community, the Johannine community, it is much closer to what we would call a democracy than it is to a monarchy. There is no question about that. We see this reflected even in the papacy of the past several hundred years, when the dogma of the Immaculate Conception was proclaimed in 1854. What did the Pope have to do? He had to consult with everybody in the whole church. What is the faith of your community? What do these people believe? And then, as an official act, he declared this part of the Catholic dogma. But it was not a unilateral, one person, one vote operation. Unhappily, I think that's the normal consciousness of most Catholics today. That this is the way it's supposed to be. Now, the 21st chapter of the Gospel of John makes it very clear that that's not what it's supposed to be. That the church, like every human institution, has taken on all kinds of coloration over the centuries. So that even one of the most autocratic popes of our century, John Paul II, wrote an entire encyclical letter called Ut Unum Sint, in which he asked all the Catholics and the non-Catholics of the world to say, we have to revise our understanding of the papacy in the 21st century. The only people I know who officially responded to that were a bunch of Anglicans. The people in the Curia got very nervous. No, 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 Pope, we don't want to do that. We just know the way things are right now is grace. But it's not. In many ways, we are a dysfunctional family. And that dysfunctionality is manifest in a number of ways, most notably, probably, in the pedophilia thing, where bishops who know what's best can conceal, can deceive, can pretend. Why? Because we have this great pyramidal structure which is supposed to be the church, with the Pope knowing everything, and the Cardinal knowing a little less, and the Archbishop knowing a little less. That's nonsense, folks. That's nonsense. What does it mean to feed somebody? See, here again, we have to be very careful of that metaphoric language. If I were a first century person living in Palestine, the model of a shepherd would make all kinds of sense. I bet there's nobody in this room who's ever seen a real honest-to-God live shepherd and what they have to do to shepherd sheep. But that was a reasonable metaphor. We are not sheep, folks. We are not sheep, nor lambs, nor should we be. We are human beings who are to be tended, nourished. And let me make a couple of suggestions as to what shape nourishment takes. As a parent and as a human being, one of the very first forms of nourishment is trust. To trust another person provides a kind of nourishment that is available in no other way. And all you have to do is look at your own experience. When were you last profoundly trusted? And what did that do to expand your interior reality? To be trusted, to be held responsible, to be understood, to be accountable for your own behavior. It's only, and the text says it itself, because of Peter's supposedly greater love that he can operate. And how does a loving leader act? By consulting? By listening? By trying to understand point of view other than his or her own? And I put it to you, there are no alternatives to that. There are no alternatives to that. And now to the religious valence of all this, which is what it's supposed to be all about. What does it mean? It's very nice to say, Papa knows best. And my only job is, as a pope of the early 20th century put it, my only job is to pay, pray, and obey. St. Pius X's famous description of the laity. To pay, pray, and obey. There's something profoundly wrong with that. But it's comfortable because then I don't have to take responsibility for anything. I just get, what's my marching orders today? What do you want today, boss? And then you go toddle along without having to examine anything. Your own life, your own place. Above all, your own relationship, because that's what the church is supposed to be. The Second Vatican Council, in its document on the church, did not first say that the church is hierarchical. It said, first of all, the church is a community of equals. Which is exactly what Paul kept saying, what the Gospel of Matthew kept saying, which is that scintilla of truth from the Johannine community. We really are. It is extremely important that we understand these texts. Otherwise, you just say, oh, the Pope says, oh, Jesus said, Benedict 15, feed these guys, tend them, keep them in line, and everything's settled. It is not. It is not that way. It is not that way. And you cannot appeal either to the Christian tradition or to Scripture to warrant that self-understanding or that understanding of the nature of the church. God wants us to be with each other. And you are not able to be with each other if you're treated as children all the time. We can't have a community that way, although it is comfortable. It relieves me of enormous ranges of responsibility. But it's a betrayal. Failure to take my own humanity seriously and the humanity of the hierarchy, whatever shape that takes today, seriously as well. And that's what we're called to. And nothing else. To form the people of God.